Picture a freezing meadow outside Salzburg, June 1964. Julie Andrews, just 28 and virtually unknown on film, stands shivering between takes, pulling grass from her costume while a helicopter circles overhead. Each pass knocks her flat to the ground. Studio executives are panicking about the budget. The director needs this shot to work. Everything depends on whether audiences will accept a nun spontaneously bursting into song on an alpine hillside. That gamble became one of cinema's most recognized moments, launching a film that would earn 5 Academy Awards, reach over 1.2 billion viewers worldwide, and sell more than 20 million soundtrack copies. Yet the real story behind The Sound of Music reveals something far more complex than the fairy tale on screen, a transformation of Maria von Trapp from a blunt, formidable woman who married her employer and escaped the Nazis into nothing less than a secular saint. Maria's tyrannical uncle Franz left lasting scars from her childhood. She found refuge at Vienna's State Teachers College and in Austria's mountains. Unlike petite Julie Andrews, the real Maria was substantial and formidable, often compared to Katharine Hepburn for her no-nonsense energy. After a spiritual revelation in the Alps, 19-year-old Maria joined Naumburg Abbey, desperately seeking love and security. The cloistered life didn't suit her restless spirit. Maria constantly broke rules to experience nature's beauty, often kissing the floor preemptively before looking out windows, acknowledging her inevitable disobedience. When the opportunity arose to tutor Captain von Trapp's daughter, the nuns likely welcomed her departure. Captain George von Trapp, decorated naval hero who lost both his career after World War I and his wife Agatha to scarlet fever, did use a bosun's whistle, though only to locate his children on the large estate. The film's cold martinet? Pure fiction. George was warm and loving, while Maria, emotionally stunted from her loveless childhood, was the one who needed thawing. Standing on a stepladder polishing a chandelier, Maria learned of the captain's proposal when the children announced, "Papa says he will marry you." Her reaction wasn't joy, but devastation. Feeling her heart, which had so longed to give itself entirely to God, felt rejected. She only agreed after the Mother Superior convinced her it was God's will, inverting Hollywood's gazebo romance entirely. Whether the von Trapps sang before Maria remains disputed. Maria claimed they didn't sing, while Dadder Maria recalled their home sounded like a musical conservatory. After their 1927 marriage, Father Franz Wasner transformed casual music making into professional performance, becoming the true architect of the Trapp family singers. Their European success preceded their 1938 flight from Austria. Maria's 1949 memoir caught German filmmakers' attention, spawning 2 successful films. When Broadway producers approached Rodgers and Hammerstein for a single song, the duo proposed a full musical, their final collaboration as Hammerstein's health was failing. The 1959 Broadway production, starring Mary Martin, divided critics but enchanted audiences, driving 1,443 performances and 6 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. When 20th Century Fox acquired film rights in 1960 for $1.25 million, the studio desperately needed a hit after the Cleopatra disaster. Producer Richard Zanuck saw The Sound of Music as salvation, but acclaimed directors fled. Gene Kelly told screenwriter Ernest Lehman, "Go find someone else to direct this piece of shit." Robert Wise finally accepted, despite initially dismissing the material as too saccharine. Wise assembled an Oscar-winning team. Production designer Boris Levin, Moscow-born with 9 nominations, would blend authenticity with theatricality. Cinematographer Ted McCord, whose career began in 1917, had mastered outdoor work through westerns. Editor William Reynolds, Wise's collaborator since 1951, practiced understated editing. Try to make the best possible version of what you take to be the director's idea of the film. Costume designer Dorothy Jenkins brought meticulous character development using only period authentic materials. In summer 1963, casting Julie Andrews seemed unlikely. With Mary Poppins unreleased, studios wanted proven stars. Richard Rogers championed her, having known her talent since the mid-1950s. After viewing 5 minutes of unreleased Mary Poppins footage, Wise declared, "Let's go sign her right now." Andrew signed for $225,000, immediately asking, "Now, what are we going to do to take all the schmaltz out of this?" For Captain Von Trapp, Wise remained convinced Christopher Plummer was perfect despite his reluctance to play a stick figure in an operetta. Plummer agreed on condition he could add depth with Lehman. Though he dismissed Edelweiss as boring, schmaltzy, and trite, he came to appreciate Lehman's transformation of the captain into Maria's worthy partner. When the 60-person company arrived in Austria in April 1964, they faced unexpected challenges. Andrews worked nonstop from 6 a.m., managing doubts about portraying the perfect stepmother while her one-year-old daughter remained in others' care. Plummer, with ample free time, explored the countryside and indulged in the beer, the quiche, the schnapps, until he looked like Orson Welles and required new costumes. The Do-Re-Mi sequence became the film's musical centerpiece, a 9-minute montage spanning 9 Salzburg locations. Despite freezing temperatures and rain delays, Andrews kept spirits high by singing to the children during breaks. For the title song, Andrews was transported to the meadow in an ox cart, wrapped in a mink coat. The meadow's owner screamed in German, worried his cows weren't producing milk. After relining an artificial brook and positioning trees for dappled lighting, they captured 20 precious minutes of sunshine. Andrews hopped on stones and tossed pebbles perfectly timed to pre-recorded music, creating the iconic sequence that would define her career. The Minneapolis preview audience braved freezing temperatures and fell in love. At intermission, they gave a spontaneous standing ovation. The scorecards were overwhelming. 223 excellent, 3 good, 0 fair. Fox granted a $3 million advertising budget with reserved seats and limited showings. By the March 2, 1965 premiere, Fox had revised estimates upward to $60 million. When Andrews appeared twirling with arms spread wide, bursting into The Hills Are Alive, audiences were enchanted. Then critics attacked. Bosley Crowther dismissed it as operatic kitsch, while Pauline Kael declared it the single most repressive influence on artistic freedom in movies. This hostility reflected a cultural shift toward irony, critics enraged by this resolutely old-fashioned film. Despite critical disdain, The Sound of Music became a global phenomenon through extraordinary word of mouth. Its moral certainty offered refuge in an increasingly ambiguous landscape. The good were godly, the villains were Nazis, and real pain didn't exist. Audiences wanted to live inside the movie, finding emotional refuge that transcended critical opinion. 50 years later, The Sound of Music remains a cultural touchstone, the first major pop cultural monument erected by traditional audiences against a rapidly changing society, a defiant celebration of values that felt increasingly under siege. In a morally ambiguous world, the film offers something rare: certainty. Problems can be solved with a song. Goodness triumphs over evil. Love conquers fear. Over 1.2 billion people have found something worth returning to, a world that never ever was, but fulfills deep emotional needs. That's not escapism. That's why we tell stories, to remind ourselves of who we want to be, even when the world makes it difficult to believe such people exist.